This is A State of Things. I'm Connie Walker. As a society, we're fascinated by obsessed people. They populate our favorite TV shows, movies, and books. And we ourselves are a bit obsessed with people. Think of the number of magazines in the checkout stand at the grocery store right this very minute with the faces of Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie plastered across them. So what do we mean when we use the word obsession? And when does an interest turn from fascination to fanaticism? On The State of Things today, we'll consider the distinction between passion and obsession.
I might be obsessed with something for a little while, you know, short little obsessions in which I'm really obsessed with poker 1 week and then move on to cooking the next week, or really interested in watching all the movies of Chow Yun Fat.
I think I'm obsessed with my work, actually.
Obsessed to making the airport on time.
I'm obsessed with those little things that they have at the craft stores that say love and happiness and peace. But the problem is you can't get just one because you don't get that feeling. You need to have the whole bunch.
We asked a number of people at Meadowmount in Chapel Hill what they were obsessed with, and we'd love to hear from you today. What do you mean when you use the word obsession? Have you ever described yourself as obsessed, or do you know somebody else who is, and why? Our number for your calls is 1-877-962-9862, 877-962-9862. Joining us first in the studio is a man who is, by his own description, obsessed with the band Devo. He's their archivist and number one fan, Michael Pilmer. Welcome to the program.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Well, you're obsessed with the band Devo, and for people who aren't familiar with them, their most famous song is Whip It. It came out in 1980.
Right.
Some people have called Devo the one-hit wonder band, but Michael, you'd say that's not so?
That's definitely not so technically and figuratively. They had more than one hit, but Whip It was certainly their best-known song. So unfortunately, that's how everybody knows them.
Well, first of all, for you, why Devo?
Well, I think for me, when I was a kid, they appealed to me on a number of different levels. They looked different. They had kind of a uniform that they had designed. And the only other band I was into at that time who had done anything like that was Kiss, and they offered products through their albums, and they had a catalog of t-shirts and gear, memorabilia, and I was attracted to that initially. And then when I started listening to their stuff more and paying attention to their lyrics, I found that they spoke to me on another level. They kind of made sense of the world that I didn't understand at that point.
You're talking about their theory of de-evolution?
Theory of de-evolution, their warning of politics and religion. They're speaking of how man maybe wasn't the top form of life on the earth. You know, maybe man was more the problem than the solution. So it just got me looking at the world a little differently. And I was at Catholic school at the time, so it just kind of blew away a lot of the guilt and fear I had about the world, and made me think, oh, there is another way of thinking about things. You know?
And was this a sudden thing? When was the first time you saw them? Did it hit you right away?
Well, I guess I discovered them like most people did with the song Whip It, because I was living in North Carolina at the time, and the only way I would ever figure out a band like that existed was by listening to them on the radio. So yeah, Whip It opened the door, and initially I was attracted by the way they looked and the way they moved, and then later on, as I dug deeper into the lyrics and the history, it appealed to me on more levels than that.
And you're also from the same hometown they are?
Yeah, I'm from Stowe, Ohio. They're from Akron, which is basically the same neighborhood. So, and I didn't find that out until after I'd moved out of Akron. Okay. So all these parallels became apparent to me as well.
And your fascination with the band has really only grown since those first moments?
Yeah. The more I learned about them and the more I learned about their aesthetic and their whole purpose for being a band, the more I liked them. And at some point, I just decided to take it to the most ridiculous level, you know, so.
What do you mean by that?
I figured if I was going to collect a band or collect anything, I was going to do it to the extreme and really be ridiculous about it, more like an art project than a hobby, you know. It keeps growing, especially after I met the band. They kind of give me things to dare me to collect them, so I
and
have to.
And how is it that they were willing to trust somebody like you, you know, kind of this fanatical person to work for them?
I don't know. I certainly wasn't the first fanatical person to approach them and say that they changed my life, and it happens all the time. I still, when I'm at their offices in L.A. at Mark's office, he still gets phone calls and emails from people saying exactly what I said to him 10 years ago, so I don't know why. I don't know why I was chosen as the one they trusted.
Now, I understand you feel like your obsession with Devo actually replaced other obsessions that you felt were rather unhealthy.
Yeah, well, my theory on obsessions is that everybody's obsessed with something, whether it's sports or religion or whatever. They tend to either let their obsessions get the best of them or they choose their obsessions carefully. And I, at some point, I just figured that I would turn my facial tic and my hyperactivity and my obsessions with detail and lists and organization to something that I actually enjoyed. So if I listed and organized Devo memorabilia, it seemed to make me feel a little better than obsessing on being Catholic or whatever it was at the time.
Let's go to our phones. We have Clay joining us from Chapel Hill. Clay, you are a fan of Devo?
Yes, and they even sing about obsession. Uncontrollable urge?
Yes, about masturbation.
I hadn't noticed. Okay. Well,
we learned something today.
Yeah, the more you dig, the more you learn with Devo.
Oh, they're phenomenal. I saw them twice. Once in 1979 in Atlanta, and then in Greensboro a year or two later.
Clay, yeah. would you say you're obsessed with them?
Not with Devo. Maybe with music in general.
I can relate to that as well.
If I were to walk into your house, Michael, how long would it take me to recognize your preoccupation with Devo?
Oh, it'd be pretty instantaneous. I mean, I have a small house. I don't have anywhere to store anything, so everything's on the walls. So you're surrounded by weird art and Devo stuff.
Do you think that you have a clinical disease, or do you think it's just more of a fascination?
Well, I think obsessive-compulsive disorder runs in my family. My mom is fairly obsessive-compulsive. She touches a doorknob a certain number of times before she opens it. She throws salt over her shoulder. She was very into religion, and she just picked a lot of things to be obsessed about that I wanted to get away from.
The band members are all around 50 years old, and as you might expect them to sort of fade off into the sunset at some point, is that going to leave you in the lurch, or do you plan to continue this?
Well, they're touring this year, and they toured last year, and they've been playing pretty consistently for the last 10 years, at least one or two shows a year, and so this year's the biggest tour they've done in over 20 years, and it's kind of mind-blowing. I can't really understand how it happened or why it's happening, but it certainly is. So, I'm ready.
Mike Mothersbaugh, the lead singer of the band, has called you actually the sixth Devo. How did you manage to turn your obsession into something so productive?
Well, when I first met Mark and the rest of the band, I had always thought that, wow, how cool would it be to sit with Devo and talk with him about day-to-day things, the things that I was really thinking about when I was a kid. So when I finally got to meet him, I did just that. I just talked about what I was interested in, and I found out that he was interested in a lot of the same things, be it screen printing or visual art. And over the years, we just found that we shared all these things, and I started doing little projects for him on the side, screen printing T-shirts with my girlfriend at the time, and just kind of kept in his ear and kept letting him know that I was dedicated to spreading the truth about de-evolution. So at some point, after I lost a job that I had for many years, he hired me to run art tours for him. He's done visual art since before he was in Devo, and they hired me to do their website. And they kind of just took me by the hand and said, "Don't worry, the future's all right." So as it was in my childhood, they're still teaching me things and making sure I get through life okay.
Okay. What would you say is the weirdest Devo thing you have?
You mean as far as a collectible thing? It's probably like canceled health spa membership cards or credit cards or speeding tickets that the band members got. You know, it's anything they give me to collect, I have to just because it's so ridiculous.
This is The State of Things. I'm Connie Walker, in for Melinda Penkava, and we're talking today about obsessions. With me in the studio is Michael Pilmer. He's turned his preoccupation with the rock band Devo into his occupation. Have you done something similar or turned an obsession or passion into your life's work? Or maybe you have an obsession. We'd love to hear about it. 1-877-962-9862 is our phone number. And we have Leonie joining us from Oxford. Hi, Leonie.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks for calling.
Yeah. Well, my obsession is I enjoy wearing beautiful shoes, comfortable shoes, and I enjoy looking at them.
I think that's a fairly common one for women.
Probably so.
How many shoes do you have?
Oh, gosh, I couldn't tell you. I don't think I have reached the 100 pair mark, but, you know, I'm up there, at least 60 or so.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for sharing your experience. We also have with us on the line Dr. John March, who's a psychiatry professor and chief of child and adolescent psychiatry at Duke Medical Center. Thank you very much for being with us, John.
It's a pleasure.
Well, I wonder if you could give us your take on our Devo devotee, Michael, here in the studio. Do you think he has a problem, or is this fairly harmless?
No, he sounds like a really lovely and interesting guy.
Thanks.
does this kind of obsession for Devo sound at all like some of the cases that you've seen?
No, in fact, there's a pretty sharp distinction between people who are passionate about something and derive a great deal of pleasure from it, and obsessive-compulsive disorder, where the obsessions and the rituals that follow from the obsessions feel much more like an invading army, kind of like a thought hiccup that won't go away. They provide no pleasure. There's nothing positive about them. The person who has them hates them. In fact, there's nobody who hates OCD more than the person who has it. So the experience of the individual who has OCD is very different than the person who likes Devo or likes shoes or prefers only to eat peanut butter.
Okay, this is A State of Things. I'm Connie Walker in for Melinda Pankava, and we're talking about obsessions today. With me in the studio, Michael Pilmer, who's turned his preoccupation with the rock band Devo into his occupation. We're also talking with Dr. John March, a psychiatry professor and chief of child and adolescent psychiatry at Duke Medical Center. We'll continue our conversation. You can join in. Tell us about your obsessions at 1-877-962-9862 is our phone number. This is A State of Things. I'm Connie Walker in for Melinda Pankava. We're talking today about obsessions. In the studio with us is Michael Pilmer, who's devoted to the rock band Devo, and he's actually turned that preoccupation into his occupation. We are also talking with Dr. John March, who is a psychiatry professor and chief of child and adolescent psychiatry at Duke Medical Center. And we wonder if you have an obsession, or maybe you've even turned it into your life's work. You can join our conversation at 1-877-962-9862. John March, what is the difference between a passion and an obsession?
On the simplest level, passions are pleasurable. They can, if they become excessive, even though they're pleasurable, interfere with the ordinary tasks of daily living in the way an addiction would interfere. So somebody whose passion happens to be cocaine, which triggers all the reward systems, pleasure systems in the brain, would have a passion that doesn't work very well for them. On the other hand, the obsessions of obsessive-compulsive disorder are not at all pleasurable. There's nothing pleasurable about them. They're always involve an uncomfortable feeling, either fear or harm or a complex emotion like disgust or a feeling of things just aren't quite right. But whatever it is, it nags at you and feels terrible. So I think the probably best distinction is that passions are pleasurable. OCD is very unpleasurable.
So somebody who has to have chocolate every day probably doesn't have OCD.
I think there are lots of people who like chocolate, and very few of them probably have OCD.
What are some of the manifestations of OCD over the years? I mean, what do you see people actually doing?
Well, OCD is actually quite stereotypic. There are certain categories of obsessions and compulsions which are common in children, adolescents, and in adults and across cultures. So the commonest one is concerns about contamination, dirt, germs, chemicals, radiation, and those tend to produce a lot of washing and cleaning rituals. There are fears of harm, that something you might do something or think something that would cause something bad to happen to somebody, typically produces a lot of checking rituals to make sure that nothing bad has actually happened. Another category is what's called scrupulosity. It can be moral or religious, feeling like you've had a bad thought and because of that God will be mad at you and send you and all your relatives to hell, and so you try to OCD gets you to cancel that bad thought out by doing a lot of praying rituals and reassurance seeking. Hoarding is another one. People who have difficulty throwing things away, often because they fear if they don't have it, something bad will happen, but sometimes because it just makes them uncomfortable. So there are a whole variety of sort of stereotypic themes in OCD, none of which involve anything that's socially useful or pleasurable.
Elizabeth joins us on the line from Raleigh. Hi, Elizabeth. You're on the air.
Hi. We have a son who has Asperger's syndrome, and he's very high functioning. He just graduated from Emory University. And he, one of the defining things about his youth is he did get these sort of, I called them sort of obsessions. He would get these intense interests in cars, in maps, and things like that. And he would spend long periods of time on them. And I worked really consistently with him to not allow this to go on for longer than I felt reasonable. But I could tell it was a way of reducing anxiety for him. And it was sort of, we called it an obsession, and he's done very well about kind of modifying his own behavior over the time of not staying with something for too long a period of time. But one of the things is it's not terribly functional, and that's one of the things I noticed. I mean, he would memorize the whole map of Raleigh, for instance. He knew where every street was in the city and that kind of thing. But he's done a very good job. He's changed obsessions, I will say that, and they've become a little more sort of socially useful, like music, that kind of thing.
John March?
You know, I wondered whether someone would call in and bring this up, because there's an interesting overlap between the pervasive developmental disorders, and Asperger's is one of those, and obsessive compulsive disorder. Kids or young adults who have Asperger's tend to have very narrow thematic focused interests. They're like critters that can only inhabit a very small ecological niche, and within that niche, they're pretty happy, and outside of that niche, they're panic-stricken. Hmm. So for a whole variety of reasons, they tend to be a train that's only got one track. At times, people who have this particular cognitive style or flavor will develop frank obsessive-compulsive disorder, and in fact, they're probably vulnerable to it. So you see some overlap between those things. So they're really, given what we were talking about before, there are people that are obsessed because they're passionate, there are people that are obsessed because they have OCD, and then there's this other group, which is not all that uncommon, actually, that have a lot of difficulty switching train tracks. They tend to get stuck on whatever it is they're thinking about and don't move away from that, and that's a third group of patients who tend to be obsessed.
Michael Pilmer, you were nodding your head during Elizabeth's phone call.
Yeah, I was just thinking, you know, a lot of these things you're talking about, a lot of these OC tendencies, I think, very close to falling prey to early on in childhood. And I was obsessed with lists and organization and putting things in categories. And I had a facial tic, and I was diagnosed as hyperactive. And I'm just wondering how all this relates to obsessive compulsiveness, because I think I redirected my obsessions over time, and eventually the facial tic went away. Lists and organization I used for my collecting and archiving, and so it all became kind of more leveled out for me. I'm just wondering what you think of that.
Well, it's very interesting. You know, we have this these diagnostic classifications in psychiatry, and in fact they're very primitive. My guess is 25 to 50 years from now, because the brain is so interesting and so complicated, that there'll be as many subspecialties in clinical neurosciences as there are in the whole rest of medicine. So OCD is not one thing. It's probably a dozen different things. And there are lots of overlap between these conditions, because the systems in the brain that are involved in generating these emotional or behavioral or thinking hiccups tend to overlap across the conditions. So I think it's actually not surprising that there are some features of narrow kind of perseverative interests in a person who also had ADHD, which is a difficulty of attention regulation, and also ticking, which is the motor equivalent of these same phenomenon. What I think, Michael, is really cool is that you've parlayed this into a ecological niche that you like and are happy in, and that's the most important outcome at all. We've got this crazy culture that thinks that everybody ought to be perfect and have straight teeth and graduate from college and be able to do lots and lots of different things, and you know, play soccer and all that sort of advertising-created need. And my own view is it's the diversity and wonderfulness of you know, humanity that makes life joyful and worth celebrating. And to pathologize a lot of this, I think, is not such a great idea.
When is it actually, though, that the passion becomes a clinical problem? At what point would you consider that somebody actually needs to go for help?
Well, they're really two sort of simple answers to that question, but they have a lot of validity for, you know, for people. The first is if it's distressing to you, like the woman who called in whose son has Asperger's. It's great that he liked to memorize maps, but if that's the only thing he liked to do and wouldn't get his homework done or go to bed that's all he wanted to talk about, to the point he was driving everybody crazy, it's both likely to be distressing for him in the sense that it causes a lot of friction, and it's also associated with functional impairment. So at the simplest level, if it causes you distress or it gets in the way of living a full and rewarding life, then you've transitioned from sort of normal obsessiveness to something that's more pathological. But that doesn't necessarily mean it's OCD. It could be a whole variety of other things.
You're listening to The State of Things on North Carolina Public Radio. We're talking today about obsessions. Our guests at the moment include Michael Pilmer, who is preoccupied with Devo and actually works for the band, and also Dr. John March, a psychiatry professor and chief of child and adolescent psychiatry at Duke Medical Center. If you have an obsession or experience with someone who is obsessed, you can join our conversation at 1-877-962-9862. John March, what do we actually know about the causes of obsessive-compulsive disorder?
Well, OCD is it's really the paradigmatic neuropsychiatric illness. It begins in childhood or adolescence in about half the cases. It doesn't get better on its own. It's often accompanied by a tic disorder and sometimes by attention deficit disorder. There is one discrete cause of OCD that we know about. It turns out that it's actually, in a small percentage of kids, probably a variant of rheumatic fever. There's a form of rheumatic fever called Sydenham's chorea, which looks a lot like the tic disorders, and kids who have rheumatic fever often have a lot of obsessive compulsive symptoms. We know that it's genetic. 20 to 30% of people who have OCD will have a family member that has OCD. We don't have the specific genes identified at this point, but it's quite likely that we will within the next 5 years identify a number of risk genes for OCD. And we have a pretty good understanding of what the OCD circuits are, the circuits in the brain that are hiccuping in patients who have OCD. They connect an older part of the frontal cortex called the orbital frontal cortex to subcortical structures, particularly an area called the caudate nucleus. So we have a neuroanatomy for OCD. We know how our treatments are beginning to understand how our treatments, both cognitive behavioral psychotherapy and medication, alter that neuroanatomy back toward normal function. And we know something about the genetics or history of the disorder with respect to family members, but we don't have the disease genes yet.
We're going to turn in a moment to somebody who actually has been diagnosed with obsessive compulsive disorder. But John March, one more quick question for you. Is it curable?
Absolutely. In fact, it's interesting. Most people with OCD are taking one of the serotonin reuptake inhibitors, drugs like Zoloft or Prozac, and they're often given one of the atypical neuroleptics, drugs like Risperdal, because for the most part, the serotonin reuptake inhibitors hit singles and doubles, not home runs. In fact, the best treatment for OCD is a form of psychotherapy called cognitive behavioral psychotherapy, which is analogous to physical therapy for a joint. So if you think about OCD as a frozen shoulder or a blown out knee, you need to rehab the brain using a very target-specific form of psychosocial intervention, and it's at least 2 or 3 times more effective than the medications. Unfortunately, it's not widely available. It should be much more widely available.
Michael Pilmer, have you sought treatment at all?
Only self-induced treatment.
Okay. We're going to turn now to someone who was diagnosed with obsessive-compulsive disorder at the age of 24. Amy Walensky is on the line from New York. She's the author of the book Passing for Normal, A Memoir of Compulsion. Thanks for being with us, Amy.
Glad to be here.
Well, it wasn't until 24, as I noted, that you were diagnosed with OCD and you actually began therapy. Now, that was 10 years ago, and I understand the disorder no longer impedes your living. But how was OCD manifested in your day-to-day life before you actually went out and sought help?
I had a lot of checking, counting rituals. I didn't have any of the sort of cleanliness genre, but I definitely had a number that I fixated on, which was 6, and I did a lot of counting back and forth to 6. I also did some hoarding. I had a lot of rules and rituals that I lived by. I think I'm probably what would be called a sort of, or was, a high-functioning obsessive-compulsive, which is why I wasn't diagnosed until I was in my 20s. I think I managed to get through each day without attracting any attention from outside people, but the toll it was taking on me internally was incredibly stressful and time-consuming, and I think for me it was the cognitive behavioral therapy that really remarkably quickly changed everything for me, and I it's actually been 11 years since that diagnosis, and I think today I'm much more prone to obsessions of a positive nature, which are, you know, there's a fine line between an intense passion and an obsession, and I'm not sure what to call it, but I think that's more where I am today.
That's a great question. Well, how did you try to hide your disorder from other people as you were growing up?
Well, I definitely would my sort of most intense or drawn out rituals were things that were performed in private or at home as opposed to school. I think I've found that that's true of a lot of children, adolescents. You know, the last thing you want to do is attract attention for doing something strange. I had one sort of tapping ritual that was when I entered my childhood home. I had a whole series of taps, light switches, and the tops of stairs and things like that from the front door to the bedroom. And years later, after I'd been diagnosed and had a much more clear understanding of what had been going on, I clocked myself doing this and realized that I had been spending, you know, just way too much time every day doing these tapping rituals just to get upstairs.
What did you think at the time? I mean, did you just think there's something wrong with me, or?
Yeah, I knew it wasn't. I mean, I think that's, to me, that's one of the fascinating things about obsessive compulsive behaviors is you're fully aware while it's happening that it's not rational. I mean, a rational, sane person knows, that tapping a light switch 6 times has absolutely no connection to, you know, the safety of their plane flight to San Francisco. But because it's a real verifiable brain glitch, you become momentarily tricked or persuaded into seeing a connection. And then as soon as you've done the taps, you can again say, that was weird, that doesn't make any sense, I don't know why I did that. But it's very difficult to get out of that cycle by yourself. And I spent years all through my adolescence thinking, if I would just try a little harder, I could fix this, I could stop doing it. And it wasn't until I learned how to go about doing that with the support of somebody really great here in New York City that I was able to overcome it to the extent that I have today.
Are there traces of it left in your life today?
Well, I think I'll always be prone to obsessive compulsive behaviors, especially under duress. I think my big fears that I think most people with obsessive compulsive disorder have certain fears or anxieties they're trying to assuage by performing the rituals. And mine always had to do with illness or danger. In particular, plane travel was really a big source of it for me. And I think that now, before I take a long flight or any flight, or if I notice something unusual health-wise, I'm prone to, I can sense myself wanting to do some of these rituals, but I know enough now to really, for me it was always a spiral. When they would get bad, they would get worse really quickly. So I don't want to, I know enough now to stop them when I sense them, you know, wanting to rear their head again.
Let's bring in a caller. Jay joins us from Raleigh. Thanks for calling us, Jay.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. It's actually for all your guests. There are depictions of OCD in film and TV. I could think of 2 examples for this question. One would be the USA Network show Monk with Tony Shalhoub, and the other would be the latest movie with, I don't remember the star actually, forgive me, but the movie was Aviator, and it's about Howard Hughes. And I'd like to ask each of the guests what they view as these depictions of OCD and whether or not they see those kind of depictions in their lives as being a positive and reinforcing one where people can understand them better, or if it, the character just got it all wrong.
John March?
Actually, I'm not sure that I understand the question. Could I ask the guest to rephrase it?
Well, I think he was talking about some sort of depictions of OCD in sort of popular movies and TV specials, and whether that's accurate.
Oh, okay. It varies all over the map. The depiction, for example, in the movie Where's Bob, I thought was horrible. I actually walked out of that movie. I was so angry because if I'd been a patient with OCD or thinking about my patients, I would have felt stigmatized and really misrepresented. On the other hand, the Jack Nicholson movie, I think, As You Like It, I forget the title.
As Good as It Gets.
As Good as It Gets, actually, was in some ways a kind of interesting and neat portrayal of someone with OCD, because it really let you see past the disorder to this wonderful, neat human being who was kind of trapped in the illness. My experience with similar media presentations around OCD is it depends on the extent to which the person who's making the presentation or doing the movie or the song or whatever it might be,
okay,
actually knows someone with OCD and talks to people who have it. Who've had OCD or have OCD, or and people who
okay.
treat them.
Thank you, John Marshall, sir. We need to take a short pause here. So we'll continue our conversation. Amy Walensky, thank you so much for joining us for this segment of the program.
Sure.
Amy Walensky is author of Passing for Normal, a memoir of compulsion. We're talking about obsessions. Our other guests include Michael Pilmer, more than just a fan of the band Devo, and Dr. John March, a professor of psychiatry. Just ahead, more of your calls at 1-877-962-9862 on the state of things. This is a state of things. I'm Connie Walker in for Melinda Penkava. We're talking during this portion of the hour about obsessions in our lives as we think of the word clinically and as it's popularly used. Devo devotee Michael Pilmer is with me in the studio. We're also joined on the line by Dr. John March, professor of psychiatry and chief of child and adolescent psychiatry at Duke University Medical Center. And we're taking your calls at 1-877-962-9862. Michael Pilmer, you want to follow up on our last caller's comments?
I just wanted to mention that as far as the tapping fixation, I remember I can still see my mom doing that all through my childhood, tapping light switches, doorknobs, and generally being obsessed with cleaning up every little bit of cat hair or dust or whatever. And I remember at the time my obsessions lied more in guilt based on my Catholic beliefs at the time and fear of the afterlife, and if I said the Lord's name in vain, I would go to hell. And so all these things just keep leading me to believe that I was just on the edge of falling into a lot of typical OC behavior before I kind of learned more about what other people thought about the guilt and fear based with religion, and I got past it all somehow.
I'm going to go next to a caller from Raleigh, Virginia. Hello.
Hi. Yeah, my dad used to have OCD, and it was really bad. He had a lot of tics and stuff when he was a kid. He never got treatment for it, but somehow he kind of made his way through it anyway. I kind of think it's because he was so smart, he just found ways to reason around it and get himself out of it. And I was wondering, I mean, was it because he was so smart, or I don't really understand how he was able to do it himself without any therapy?
John March?
Well, it's interesting. The treatment for OCD, the best available treatment, is to do the opposite of what OCD tells you to do. So, for example, if you have a fear that by touching a doorknob or using a public restroom, you'll get some dread disease and you'll die and your family members will die, the thing to do is to go, and your ritual to handle that, because you know you can't avoid touching doorknobs, is to go into the bathroom and wash your hands for 20 or 30 minutes in a ritualized way. The treatment actually is to is to go touch the doorknob and not wash. And we do this in an orderly sort of way, kind of like teaching someone to swim. You start at the putting your face in the water and hang out in the low end and go to the deep end, and then you jump off the low board and then eventually the high dive. But my guess is what happened is that your dad spontaneously discovered that if he didn't do what OCD was telling him to do, that in fact nothing bad happened. And so he did more of that and more of that until finally he got on top of OCD instead of OCD being on top of him.
It's interesting. There's a Devo lyric that I learned when I was a kid, and they say, "Why believe in things that make it tough on you?" And that really helped cure a lot of my OC behavior. I just stopped doing it because it did make it tough on me.
Yep, it's very important, I think.
Our next caller is Mike from Chapel Hill. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I just wanted to thank you for the program and to tell you that it helps me to realize why that every time I use matches out of a book, I had to use them in a specific order and still do the same thing. And every time I turn something up to my lips to take a drink, I have to take 7 sips. And it just helps a lot to know. I've been given problems through my life about being so obsessive about things. And my roommates, for instance, when I was in college, I wanted the windows clean in the house. And they said, if I wanted them clean, clean them, but not bother them about it. And just, I've always wanted things to be neat and in the right order. But the matches always bothered me to why I always had to take them out and then leave spaces between them and then finally end up with only 2 with exactly the right distance between them.
So were you aware of what was happening or that you may have had OCD?
Well, I never had a name for it. And everybody just, you know, told me I just worried too much and I needed to shut my mind down and not worry so much about things. So I've gone through, you know, trying to not be an alcoholic to shut my mind down to quit worrying all the time about every little nitty-gritty detail about stuff. So, and it's in my family. You know, I've come from a large family, lots of aunts and uncles, and there's all times blow-ups. I mean, we can't be into business together because every now and then it just gets so picky that you just can't handle each other, you know. So you kind of learn and look around and see. I graduated 4th in my high school class, and you know, I've always excelled, but you know, I always wondered what was wrong with me, basically, because I always stood out.
Michael Pilmer, did you hear those kinds of things too from other people?
Yeah, and I almost think it's like maybe people with overactive brains, their brains try to figure out ways for them to use their brain power in these meaningless ways just to take up that energy your brain has to want to figure things out or organize things or make things symmetrical. You know, I can relate to all that stuff, definitely.
We have a caller on the line. Ken joins us from Raleigh. Hi, Ken.
Hi, how are you?
Fine.
Terrific. Great show, guys. The reason I called, I am a documentary filmmaker, and for the past 5 years, I have been shooting a 13-hour documentary on Elvis Presley. And I've gone over 250,000 miles shooting this thing, and I was struck by 2 things in the process of doing the film. The first was how there are literally tens of thousands of people who are absolutely obsessed with Elvis, a guy who clearly has been dead for a great deal of time. And the other thing was that I was never an Elvis fan when I started this film, but I'm starting to feel like this is something that one can catch, because the more I do the film, the more I know about Elvis, and the more I know about Elvis, the more I do the film. It could be a 50-hour documentary if I just allowed myself to keep shooting.
John March, is it contagious?
Probably not. In fact, one of the interesting things, if you look in families, is that you may have a mom who's got contamination fears and washing rituals, and a son who has symmetry rituals where things have to be evened up or balanced. It's the broad sort of phenotype of OCD that seems to track in families, not the particulars of it. So there's no real evidence that you can learn OCD, that someone who doesn't have OCD can develop OCD just from hanging around somebody who's got it.
Okay, thank you very much to all of our guests, Dr. John March, Professor of Psychiatry and Chief of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at Duke University Medical Center, Michael Pilmer, archivist for the band Devo, thanks for being here. We also heard from Amy Walensky, author of Passing for Normal, A Memoir of Compulsion.